Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to WithInsightsRadio.com on the Blog Talk Radio Network, your free online holistic publication resource radio for trusting your intuition, achieving self-discovery, and following your soul self.
Thank you very much, Ignacio, our good friend Ignacio, giving us a good introduction. This is Chief Cloudpiler again. I'm here with Chief Wilamutkin, and this is our weekly rant. Sometimes we don't get on weekly.
Yeah, we skipped last week for Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving. We're always going to do that on holidays, by the way. Just a fair warning, right?
Yeah. I mean, we could have, but we were pretty busy, so.
Yeah, it was. We've had a little car trouble. Our cars are all pretty uniformly broken down, but the old farm crummy, so here we are.
Still as reliable as ever.
Well, still as unreliable as ever. We're commuting into Springfield in the old farm crummy, which was really never intended to do much putt around on the gravel roads out there, but we're doing it. But what it does is it makes, you know, you have so many people all trying to work their schedules together.
Juggling the one car.
The one decent car we get the others fixed. It puts a bind on things, and you don't realize, you know, how really effective it is at just shutting everything down until you get five people who all need the car at once. And Thanksgiving, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Also more people around. But anyway, enough with excuses.
Hi, we're back.
We're back, yeah. We love doing this sometimes, however. We're not exactly sure what we want to talk about till we get here, and in thinking about it, something we need to talk about is the flu. I mean, flu season's right on
season
us. Yeah, we're right on us.
People are down with the flu every which way we look.
Yeah, it's early. They're down with the flu early this year. Technically, the flu season doesn't even really begin till December the 20th.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the CDC says, right? But we know. Flu season begins when the flus begin to start popping up, and epidemics don't really hit until a little bit later. It's usually the second wave that starts to get reported in the media and by the doctors and everything. It was the second wave last year in Stockton when the hospital was and the doctor's offices were telling people to keep their kids at home.
Right.
Don't even bring them in. Mm-hmm. But it was after the flu was well seeded in the community. And that's the nature of influenza. I'm going to read a little bit. I know you kind of made a face when I said we're going to read a little bit. Nobody gets on a radio show to listen to somebody read. But this is important stuff. It's from Stephen Herrick Buhner, Herbal Antivirals, Natural Remedies for Emerging and Resisting Viral Infections. Again, I've said this over and over, but if you do not have this book, you need this book.
Mm-hmm.
And its companion, the one he wrote about antimicrobials.
I have to admit, very few things cause me to exhibit a fanboy-type behavior. But reading these books, I did chance to see on Facebook that Dr. Buhner is on Facebook, and I couldn't resist it.
Oh, is he?
I sent him a message.
What'd you send him?
Totally fanboy.
Fanboy, please. We're not worthy. You know, this man has, he's broken all the rules in the medical institutions out there. He's totally crossed the line. He's off the reservation. He's written some other things, too. You know, and the one I love,
Sacred Herbal Healing
Beers. Beers,
I love
yeah.
That.
You know, he expressed the old. He wrote a book about beers, and when you read that book, you realize about midway through that you're really reading about how herbal extracts used to all be made. And I tell you what, it was such an eye opener, an amazing thing. Nowadays, we just go down and we buy the Everclear or the vodka or whatever,
yeah.
We start doing our thing. But in the old days, they made their extracts and they actually fermented them and they became beers. And every single one of the beers had a different healing aspect to it. And that's what made the beers different. Sure, not that way today.
No, but I'm going to start making ferment. extracts.
Ferment extracts, yeah.
As soon as I have some more space to manage the ferments with.
Really cool, really cool. The ferment extract is amazing. Well, we're talking about influenza. It's important to understand the influenza virus. It is not one thing, is it?
No.
I mean, there are over 1,000 generally flowing through the country at any given time, and every single one of those are so highly mutagenic that, you know, even though you may identify one of them in one town, the same strain could be a completely different thing in another town. And so it's pretty difficult to say that the flu is the flu because it isn't. But let's read a little bit about what he says, and I apologize for reading it first, but this is such good stuff. Everybody interested in natural medicine in the flu season needs to really pay attention to this. The influenza virus is a member of the Orthomyxoviridae family. It is an RNA virus, and that means it alters its genetic structure very quickly. RNA, DNA, viruses don't have these things. The virus can't reproduce without some other organism's genetic commentary, so to speak. It has to borrow either DNA or RNA in order to actually go through the process of reproduction. And so it absolutely depends. That's the paradox of virus, because virus kills the host, and yet the virus requires the host. I haven't ever been able to really understand that. That is why a new flu shot is needed every year for those in the Western world who have such things available. The old vaccine can only help prevent infection by the strain that has emerged in that particular year. The next year, it is not the same virus, merely a similar one. Influenza viruses spread around the world every year in seasonal epidemics. 2,500,000 to 500,000 people die from them each year. About one-third of people who are infected remain asymptomatic. The rest get some degree of the, quote, flu. Asymptomatic means they don't even have symptoms. Mm-hmm. The first symptoms are usually, every single one of us have had these symptoms. So, you know, as he describes the symptoms of the flu, we're all going to, you know, be checking off the box. Yeah, did that, got that, you know, felt that. But let's just go through them as this pathologist understands the flu. The first symptoms are usually a feeling of being cold or achy, and perhaps the beginnings of a fever. High fever alternating with severe chills sets in as the infection spreads. As the virus enters the lungs and the sinus tissues, mucus congestion begins, coughing, body aches, fatigue, headache, and irritated eyes, nose, and throat are common. Yeah, they really are.
Yeah.
The last one I got, I felt like my sinuses were just on fire for hours. And that was the only symptom. I had fire in my sinuses for hours.
I felt like someone shoved a watermelon inside my skull.
Inside your skull. It was about to explode. Some people have diarrhea and abdominal pain, vomiting sometimes. Yes. So I put it. The majority of the influenza viruses are upper respiratory, but those same upper and lower respiratory viruses can cause similar symptoms as in the sinuses or the throat or the lungs down in the intestines.
Right.
So because of the similar symptoms, you know, when you get the virus and you have the snot, the discharge, your body's trying to throw that off. It's an inflammatory effect. Throwing water at it is one way of washing the virus away. You do that in the gut and you have diarrhea.
Yep.
Too much of it, you're going to have vomiting. The symptoms of the infection usually begin. Now, this is important. This is something that people don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
The symptoms of the infection usually begin the third day after infection. You don't even know for three days. But the virus is already well established by then. It starts replicating the second day, then begins shedding viral particles that are released in increasing numbers for the next 5 to 7 days. The higher the fever, the more viral organisms that are being released. Children are extremely infectious compared to adults and with very high viral loads. They also tend to have very high fevers. As the virus invades the lungs, it stimulates, you know, let's go back a little bit. You don't even have symptoms until the third day.
When it's nicely established by that point.
It's really established well, but you are infectious during all that time.
Yep.
So you're not sick, and you're spreading it to others.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crazy thing. Kind of absolutely ensures that the organism is going to get to other organisms, and that's, you know, that's the survival mechanism.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. If I were a virus, I would want to do that. Oh, but I'm not a virus. Just so you know, I'm not a virus. RNA or DNA.
Thank you.
Got my own. Thank you. As the virus invades the lungs, it stimulates inflammation in the tissues, like I was just saying. The lung cells filled with viruses soon bulge outward, and this is crazy, they explode.
Ta-da.
The cells explode. It's important to understand that once you get that, by the time you get that lung congestion, it's because your lung cells are exploding. Mm-hmm. It's not merely that the water is leaking out. It is that they're bursting open. And that's important because the virus now has to get outside the body. It has to ensure that it gets outside the body. The essence of viral shedding is what he calls this explosion of the cells. Now, it's not the virus cells that are exploding. It's the lungs.
Yep.
Unbelievable. Then the virus stimulates coughing because your lungs are exploding, spreading the virus to new hosts via respiratory droplets. So when you have that symptom, you are way infectious. Mm-hmm. One is just, you know, you're infectious and the virus is moving around, getting things started. But by the time the population is all exploding, their lungs are all exploding at once, it's a very infectious situation. Pneumonia, a severe inflammation of the lungs accompanied by massive fluid retention and an inability to breathe, is the main cause of death. People, in essence, drown.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't think of the flu that way. You know, when we have the flu, you don't think of the fact that if it goes too far, you will drown.
Mm-hmm.
There are three different groups of influenza virus denoted A, B, and C. Go figure. The ABCs of influenza. Sorry. I mean, sometimes you have to be that simplistic.
No more vitamin smoothie for you.
I know. I ruined our smoothie with those vitamins, didn't
I? It's so sad because it tasted so good yesterday.
Yeah. Sorry. Off subject. Thank you very much. Influenza A is the most virulent. Influenza A, or most people develop in childhood at least some immunity to it, thankfully. Most people. It is much less dangerous. Influenza C is fairly rare. I'm sorry, did I skip? So influenza C is fairly rare. It does infect people, sometimes severely, but it usually causes only a mild illness, generally in children. When people talk about an influenza pandemic, what they're talking about is influenza A in one of its many genetically altered forms. The 1918 pandemic was caused by an influenza A virus. He didn't say, okay, influenza B is a relatively stable virus, I skipped, and mutates much more slowly than A. There have been numerous pandemics of influenza over the years, each caused by a different strain of the virus. The one in 1918 was the beginning of the modern influenza pandemic era. Such pandemics were much less common before then. There was a long rest after 1918. Since 1957, however, they have been occurring with greater frequency. The most dangerous, that's important.
Mm-hmm.
Because what was it that came together that in 1918? When you think about it.
Animals in high populations and humans in high populations.
Yeah, you had a virus that crossed between the pig and the bird.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same place as that happened, you had the trench war, the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this amazing high density population of sick people passing it to thousands and thousands and thousands. They were all very closely associated mm-hmm. with each other. So now you come to 1957, and what changed? There was this long hiatus between in influenza, realizing, of course, that in treatment, nothing changed. But from 1918, 1922 to 1957, influenza outbreaks were rare. I mean, the pandemics were rare. Influenza wasn't. Obviously, everybody got the flu,
mm-hmm.
just like now. But the pandemics were rare. What happened between 1922 and 1957? Just logically,
going back,
that's relevant and similar to what caused the original pandemic.
It's the high density populations
of people,
of people and animals.
It's the by 1957 we began the battery mm-hmm. method, the industrial method of raising
right.
food animals.
Mm-hmm.
That's where all of this starts. The battery method was the trench
all
wars.
All the environment is
so precise.
Similar. It's
yes, precisely the same. The trench wars were a battery farm.
Yeah, I was thinking back along the lines of antibiotics, but that's a different topic.
No, they've never
been
effective.
They were in development back then.
But they've never been
effective against virus.
No, you can't treat a virus with antibiotic. Okay. It's never been effective, and it really has never really been in the – I mean, doctors do. They always give an antibiotic for virus. We've questioned why, and the reason is very often there are secondary
infections.
Bacterial infections. So at mm-hmm. least they can treat those, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the similarity here is in how we humans raise food animals. Massive, high concentrations, you know, like the trenches
mm-hmm.
in France. And now the most common thing in the South, which is a much more conducive environment to raise virus. Oh, wait, raise chickens and pigs and virus. They're raising them in the same farms in buildings right next to each other. And it's the cross of the bird and the pig, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So that's why by 1957... influenza started to become much more prevalent because of the way we raise our food. Go figure. Go figure. The influenza, blah, 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 blah. The most dangerous strains currently are H1N1, which caused the flu pandemic of 1918, H2N2, which caused the Asian flu pandemic in 1957, H3N2, which caused the Hong Kong flu pandemic in 1968, and a relatively new one, H5N1, known as avian or bird flu, which caused a pandemic in 2004. The H1N1 came again. It was the source of the swine flu epidemic or pandemic in 2009 and is a modified descendant of the 1918 H1N1. So what's the difference between an epidemic and a pandemic?
You know, I don't think I've ever looked that up.
Epidemic is a demic that begins in an epicenter
right.
and tends to remain in that locality.
A pandemic spreads across multiple localities.
It spreads across the world.
Yeah.
So when you get the thing spreading across the world, you officially have a pandemic.
Yeah, and I thought epidemics were regional.
Right.
Primarily regional.
Epicenter,
yeah.
regionally
mm-hmm.
located. The influenza virus alters its genetic structure rather significantly every year by passing through both pigs and birds. And on that trip, it exchanges genetic material with other viruses and reworks its own. What's this starting to sound like? This is starting to sound a little sinister, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What does GMO mean? Genetically.
Run alert!
genetically. Modified
yeah.
organism. Do you know?
Well, we use virus to modify genes all the time.
That is what makes it sound so similar, because if it had not been for the great epidemic, the
mm-hmm.
the Spanish flu, we would not have genetically modified
mm-hmm.
organisms. They use virus to make the mutation mm-hmm. happen because it is so mutable. Then it spreads around the world again by plane and boat and rail and car, infecting millions, causing what we call the yearly flu season. But every so often, it develops a much more virulent strain, sometimes through unique genetic rearrangements, sometimes through species jumps, sometimes through both. The Asian flu pandemic in 2004 was a species jump. The swine flu epidemic of 2009 was a unique genetic rearrangement. It occurred when the virus took advantage of giant agribusiness animal crowding. We just talked about that. Who knew? Viral geneticists have traced the lineage of the 2009 swine flu epidemic, a virulent H1N1, just like the old Spanish flu, to an H3N2 strain that emerged in 1998 in U.S. factory farms, specifically huge hog farms in which the animals are so tightly packed together that they literally cannot move. This H3N2 strain, combined with another swine strain, a European H1N1 variant, rearranged genetic material into a new and very potent H1N1 form, and then emerged into the human population. The earliest infections occurred in La Gloria, Veracruz, Mexico, just adjacent to a huge hog farm. The workers became infected with the new strain, went home, infected others, many of whom traveled to other cities and towns, and the pandemic began. And it was particularly deadly for those who were infected. Among those hospitalized, depending on location, up to 31% were in intensive care units, and as many as 46 of those receiving intensive care died. One of the main fears that epidemiologists and viral geneticists have is the possibility of a combined swine and avian flu strain. The crowding of human food animals, similar to the crowding of soldiers in trenches in World War I, continually allows for the emergence of potentially virulent strains. Chicken farms, in which unique avian flu strains can emerge, mm-hmm. and hog farms, in which unique swine strains can emerge, are perfectly positioned to allow the combination of the two into one potent and very deadly influenza strain. This kind of combined strain can then pass easily into farm workers and thence into the population at large.
Yep.
Researchers have found that indeed the H3N2 swine flu virus easily combines with H5N1 strains of avian flu. When that occurs, a tremendously pathogenic form of the virus emerges. It is, they insist, only a matter of time until it occurs on its own. In fact, studies of pigs on large farms adjacent to poultry farms have found such viral combinations already infecting pigs. That combined viral strain has not infected people, .. yet. Close quote. I love the way the guy writes. I mean, he's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, he is.
This is going to happen.
It's only a matter of time. Yeah. It's a matter of math.
You know, pull your head out. Mm-hmm. I know it's warm and it's cozy and it's just pull it out. You'll number one, you'll breathe better. But number two, you'll see things as they really are. Really as they are. So let's talk about, as healers, what we need to know, and this is the thing that natural healers are not taught. What are the dynamics of flu infection?
Well, first,
it's flu.
You
know,
it has to embed.
Well, you know, this is my question was, what are we not taught as natural healers? I mean, you talk to most natural healers, and they're not going to even. You ask that question, what are the dynamics of influenza infection? And they're going to say, Bonacet is good for the flu. Elderberry. I use elderberry.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I've had that conversation with people.
That over and over again. We have that same conversation. I did not ask you, sir,
what's
ma'am,
good for the flu.
What Dr. Christopher says is good for this or good for that. I asked you what are the dynamics of infection.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important at some point, and we teach this to our students.
Yeah.
These are the kinds of things that we talk about in terms of, and we call them mechanisms of action.
Mm-hmm.
And herbs have mechanisms of action. Drugs have mechanisms of action. Minerals have a mechanism of action. And guess what? Virus also have mechanism of action. So let's see what Dr. Buhner's take on this is. I love the way he puts it because, my gosh, it is concise and it goes right down every single symptom. Every single the case is lined out for us. Cytokines are physiological signaling molecules produced by the body for various reasons. This is something that people don't even know about.
Nope.
They're produced in the largest numbers during infections. Cytokines and their cousins, chemokines, are generally part of the innate rather than the adapted immune system. They're intended to respond to incursions into our bodies by viruses and bacteria. Another way to think of them is as inflammatory molecules. They cause various sorts of inflammation in the body. This should get the attention of all you medical doctors and all you students who are out there focusing and obsessing on inflammation.
Yeah.
We hear so much about inflammation, but never really what causes it, what it's doing, why it's there. It's just, inflammation! Take this drug. Reduce your inflammation. But this is what's really going on here. Inflammation is an important part of the human organism. If we didn't have it, we wouldn't survive to adulthood.
Right.
They cause various sorts of inflammation in the body. They are why, when you cut yourself, the wound gets red and tender and swells. The cytokines rushing to the area can create conditions in which many bacteria and viruses find it difficult to survive. So it's important to understand, while your medical doctor is saying most diseases are caused by inflammation, you know, that the inflammation is an end result. We live in a cause and effect relationship. The inflammation could be saving your life. Think about it. If inflammation is there to cause an environment in which most viruses and bacteria find it difficult to survive, should we be taking that anti-inflammatory? We should hold back on that anti-inflammatory unless the inflammation is acute.
Right.
Unless it's really threatening other functions of the body. Don't just automatically say, well, you know, most diseases and illnesses are caused by inflammation. You need to be swallowing that anti-inflammatory. Bull crap. Okay? Unfortunately for us, bacteria and viruses have also learned how to use our own immune responses for their purposes. And here's where the flu comes in.
Yeah.
The general rule in inflammation, for the most part, is to dispose the area of injury, is to indispose the area of injury to bacteria or a virus. It's part of the healing process. However, viruses are smart, and they learn. They subvert quite often to facilitate their infection of the body and their destruction of certain areas of the body. This facilitates their reproduction and allows them to gather nutrients. Influenza viruses love the lungs, and it is where they cause the greatest damage. Unlike encephalitis viruses, which love brain neurons but have to find their way to the brain after being injected into people by mosquitoes, influenza viruses don't have to work nearly so hard. I mean, they're really lazy.
Yeah.
They're taken by the location they like best simply because they are... Now, that's an interesting way of putting that. They are taken to the location they like best simply because we need to breathe. Smart. It's easy. It's quick. Boom, boom, boom. Once inhaled, the viruses begin attaching to lung cells. They use a kind of agglutinin, a substance that glues things to itself. Its name shares a root with the English glue. A hemagglutinin to bind to what are called sialic acid linkages on the surface of airway cells. This is one mechanism by which plants such as Chinese skullcap and ginger stop influenza viruses, infections. They're hemagglutinin inhibitors. So, you know, John Christopher never knew that skullcap was good for anything but to calm the hysteric woman,
mm-hmm.
because women have organs that make them hysterical.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Idiot. Chinese skullcap is an
hemagglutinin
inhibitor. Prevents the virus from being able to do what it normally does, to get a foothold in the lungs. Well, that's cool. You see, all viruses do this in their own way. They have an affinity for a unique receptor on the surface of specific cells, and in one way or another, they get to that location in those particular cells. Once there, they attach to that part of the cells. In a sense, they use that part of the host cell's membrane as a docking port.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost science fiction-y.
Well, it kind of is.
Yeah, when you get down to that size, the shapes are even that way, aren't they?
Yeah.
As soon as it attaches to a cell, the virus begins to alter the permeability of the cell wall, inducing alterations in the cell's cytoskeleton and initiating endocytosis. In other words, it makes the cell surface more soft, causes the skeletal structure of the cell to bend apart without destroying the cell quite yet, and tricks the cell into taking the virus inside it where it can't be found by the immune system. Wow, that is cool. I mean, it's not cool, but it's really smart.
It's cool.
Because, you know, the immune system cell is not going to attack self.
Mm-mm.
It's not going to attack the cell because, you know, it has this programming that says take care of the cells.
Mm-hmm.
So if the virus can wiggle its way in this way, the immune cell...
will just pass right on by?
Yeah, they just pass right on by.
Mm-hmm.
Lo, lo, lo. It does this by using... it does this by using a particular kind of enzyme, which I can't pronounce. Let's see if I can try it. Neuraminidase.
Ah, okay.
That was surprisingly
that was
easy. Surprisingly easy. Neuraminidase. That just rolls right off the tongue. Which is sometimes also called sialidase because such enzymes catalyze or break apart the sialic acid linkages on the host cell surface. Interesting. That is why neuraminidase inhibitors such as Tamiflu are effective in the treatment of influenza sometimes. They inhibit the ability of the virus to enter host cells. This stops the infection. Chinese skullcap, elder, licorice, rhodiola, ginger, isatis, lespidase bicolor, angelica, he goes on and on and on with these herbs, are all neuraminidase inhibitors. Neuraminidase inhibitors are effective against both influenza A and B. So instead of having just one drug that might do it now and then, we've got a whole list of things that the apothecary can use in different stages of the flu that inhibit the virus's ability to get into the cell.
Right.
If they can't get into the cell, they can't hide from the immune system. That's very, very important. During the process of endocytosis, now remember, that's them getting into the cell, breaking the cell wall without killing the cell and getting in there to hide. The virus stimulates the cell to create what is called a vacuole, essentially a sealed bubble that will be held inside the cell.
Mm-hmm.
Cells do this to sequester substances that can damage them. Microbes have learned to use such vacuoles for their own purposes, usually to protect the virus or bacteria from intracellular antimicrobial action. So the cell makes a vacuole.
We see that sometimes under dark field microvideography. For specific viruses, they'll leave a blistered vacuole on the white blood cells.
Right, those that attack the white blood cells. We get to see that firsthand, and it's very evident. We call it a viral blister.
It helps us identify what type of virus, if not the specific one, but at least which kind of genus, what kind of family it comes from.
No, I know. It's hard to take a, you know, the... You can't go in with a pair of tweezers and snip out a piece of lung tissue to look at, but we can take blood, and very often we can see that vacuole.
Mm-hmm.
We can see that viralized vacuole. Now, what happens then is very interesting. The virus uses its hemagglutinin to bind itself to the inside of the vacuole membrane, where it opens a pore to the cell's cytoplasm, the inside, i.e. the interior spaces. It's like a manhole. To do this, the virus uses what is called the M2 ion channel. Ion channels are tiny pores in cells that allow charged molecules to enter and exit cells, bringing food in and allowing waste out. So it uses the actual structure and function of the cell to its own advantage. That's pretty smart for a single cell organism that can't even reproduce itself without the cell. Weird. Lomatium is one of the most potent M2 inhibitors known. Let's go back a little bit. Using an M2 inhibitor blocks this process and has literally stopped the virus from replicating. Lomatium is one of the most potent M2 inhibitors known, stronger than the pharmaceutical amantadine. Wow. Sweet. Lomatium is...
trade name.
The trade name is Lomatium.
Lomatium.
We call it Kaus.
No.
Yeah, it's
really?
Bear root. Yeah.
Kaus from... Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Remember the Lomatium clan. Use of the M2 channel is specific to the influenza A virus, which is why the development of blockers for it was considered crucial. Unfortunately, the extensive... This is really important to know. Unfortunately, the extensive use of chemical M2 inhibitors, such as amantadine, in poultry farms has now created nearly complete resistance to them in all influenza A strains. So because they're dumping it into the chicken feed to keep the birds from dying from the flu, they're making it impossible to use that as a medical treatment, the amantadine, in humans. But we can use Lomatium instead because it's not like amantadine at all. Once the pore is open, the little manhole that it created, the virus this is cool. The virus disassembles itself and releases viral RNA and core proteins right into the cytoplasm, into the goop on the inside of the cell. Chinese skullcap inhibits this kind of RNA, viral RNA release. The core proteins and viral RNA form a complex that is taken into the nucleus of the cell, where the cell is stimulated to begin making copies. The cell itself makes copies of the RNA, each slightly different. The new viral RNA is combined with other newly manufactured virus components, such as neuraminidase and hemagglutinin, and assembled into new viruses. So our cells
build the
create the new viruses. So here we have this enemy that has snuck into our cells, and our dum-dum cells proceed to make copies of the enemy. Smart?
Very.
Oh, yeah, very. Very, very smart. That's crazy. These attach to the inside of the host cell membrane, a bulge forms in the membrane, and the new viruses are expressed, which means viral budding or shedding, into the extracellular matrix surrounding the cell. In other words, the cell bursts. So in reward for reproducing, for recombining, for creating, for building the virus, the cell gets to die.
Yep.
Nasty. The cell is taken over by the virus in this process, its own components depleted during the creation of new viruses. Once its resources are gone, the cell dies, and the newly created viruses move on to the new host cells, beginning the process all over again. Holy cow. The lung epithelial cells are specific sites for this process to occur. The alveoli are tiny sacs that are in the terminal end of the respiratory tree. The air we breathe travels through the bronchial tree, eventually emerging into the alveoli, where the oxygen transfuses across very thin membranes into the blood. This is how our bodies remain oxygenated. In the cells lining those tiny sacs, the viruses breed. They cause extreme inflammation or swelling of the cells in that location, with resulting edema, which is fluid accumulation. All the infected cells burst open and die as new viruses are made. So, fewer alveoli are functional. Breathing is more difficult, and the infected person has much less energy because oxygen is not making it into the blood in sufficient quantities. That's why hospitals sometimes give the infected oxygen. Pneumonia is when this process becomes severe, the sacs filling with increasing amounts of fluid, while there are fewer and fewer functional alveoli. Now the person is starting, I mean, they're hospitalized.
Yeah.
They're really starting to fail. This is pretty critical at this point. This is the elderly. This is the tiny child. You know, most of us never get to this point. But you kind of can, you can follow visually, or you can kind of imagine or paint the kind of video in your mind of how that virus is finding its way through the system and in the body. Throughout the cellular infection and replication process, the virus is also stimulating the release of cytokines by the cell. Now, here's something that we're never taught, we're too dumb to understand, but cytokines...
Hey.
Well, we are. We're idiots. I mean, we're a population of absolute morons, I guess, because only the doctors can know this stuff. And the fact is, most of them don't.
Sadly.
Well, you remember what cytokines are.
Mm-hmm.
They're those little packets.
The antiviral particulates.
Well, they're cytokines are...
Some of them are antiviral. Some of them are antibacterial. Some of them are antimicrobial. Some of them induce inflammation. They do a lot of stuff.
Cytokines are physiological signaling molecules produced by the body for a variety of reasons. So there's tons of different kinds.
Yeah.
But here's one that the virus causes the cells before they burst, causes the cells to produce. These cytokines make the tight junctions between the cells and the cellular membranes more porous and allow easier movement of viral particles through the extracellular matrix and into the cells themselves. The cytokines are also stimulated in just such a way as to keep the parts of the immune system that can kill the viruses suppressed for as long as possible. Oh my gosh! So they have defense mechanisms going on all the time. They're doing this with the cells in the lungs. Toll-like receptors, TLRs, are pattern recognition receptors that can identify different types of microbes. The virus particles stimulate these toll receptors, which begins inducing the release of nuclear factor kappa B cytokines. We're just going to call those these cytokines because, you know, we don't need all the rest of that stuff. This is an upstream cytokine, meaning that it is a powerful inhibitor of other inflammatory cytokines, an inhibitor of the cytokines that cause inflammation that makes the environment less conducive to virus or bacteria. So they stop that from happening. These things are really crazy smart. I lost my place. Other types of initiators, such as, and he lists them and their number acronyms, so I'm not going to go there, are also released as part of the body's reaction to a viral infection. Normally, these would strongly stimulate type 1 interferon production, and influenza viruses are generally very susceptible to these interferons. However, The influenza virus uses a protein, NS1 protein, which blocks the induction of type 1 interferons long enough to get established in the body. So it blocks a lot of our own defensive mechanisms. Upgrading the production of type 1 interferons with herbs such as licorice will help reduce the severity of infection. I love it that he sticks these things in there. He's not just telling us stuff that we need to know. He also tells us what we can be doing at each stage of the infection dynamic. The virus also inhibits dendritic cell maturation and activation. Those are cells, white blood cells, that have the capacity to grab the virus and destroy them.
Yeah.
That's what dendritic means. They reach out with tentacles, grab the thing, suck it in, they envelop it, and they destroy it. The virus, increasing T cell counts is particularly effective in reducing influenza severity. Licorice, elder, redroot, and zinc are specific for this. These were all really basic foods in the old days. Everybody had these things in their homes and they knew how to use them. Because of modern medicine, we have none of it. We might have a zinc lozenge for canker sores.
Maybe.
It used to be pretty popular in the 80s and the 90s. Not so much anymore. These cells are part of the adaptive immune
response.
We have
Orajel. Orajel for canker cells.
yeah, whatever.
Who needs zinc?
These cells are...
zinc in baby paste.
In baby paste, yeah.
Bum paste.
T cells are part of the adaptive immune response. Suppressing them protects the virus from attack. The body responses also stimulates the release of type 3 interferons, to which the virus is less susceptible and which it does nothing to suppress. These interferons have general rather than specific antiviral qualities and are upregulated within 3 to 6 hours of infection. This is what begins causing the general flu-like feelings that presage a full-blown flu episode. The virus itself does not make you flu-y. Your body makes you flu-y. So the virus isn't doing it.
No.
It's your body that makes you feel like you have the flu. Now, bear with me because I'm really close to, I'm going to skip around because it's kind of long. But during the same period, the infected airway cells, that's in your trachea, your bronchial, and, you know, begin generating specific cytokines and chemokines. He names them, but we're not going to read that because some of them I can't even pronounce. Then some 12 to 16 hours later, other cytokines are produced. Tumor necrosis factor alpha, also known as monocyte chemoattractant protein. The expressed cytokines make the epithelial structures more porous. This assists faster viral penetration of the cells. It also stimulates the migration of immune cells to the sites of infection. And he goes on and he goes on, but I'm going to skip because he talks about all the different kinds of cytokines and interferons. And it just, it starts to become a pylon. It becomes a dog pile. But he does say here, I should probably write, the size of the drainage lymph nodes in the lungs begins to increase. This is what also begins to make it harder.
Yeah.
Hard to breathe because you're just losing space in there. Preventing, this helps during a healthy resolution of infection to drain more of the fluids from the lungs, preventing suffocation. So in a general, you know, usually this is a good thing. Within these lymph nodes, areas called the geminal centers increase their size and development. The geminal centers are the sites where B lymphocytes are produced and are differentiated in order to attack the specific infection that is occurring. This is part of the adaptive humoral immune response. These lymph node locations, as well as those in peripheral tissues, like in the gut, for example, can become overfull during severe infection, slowing drainage and healthy adaptive immune responses. They can also, during severe infections, be specifically attacked and damaged so that they do not function at all. This is a contributor to the mortality that sometimes occur during cytokine storms. In other words, this is why herbs such as red root, immortal, and pleurisy root are useful. They all support lymph structures in the lungs and periphery.
Mm-hmm.
Red root is particularly useful in the periphery for spleen and lymph enlargement and lymph drainage. Immortal and Asclepias, with immortal, which is Asclepias. I always pronounce that wrong. I always say Asclepias.
It's Asclepias.
It's Asclepias aspirulla. It's specific for optimizing lymph drainage from the lungs. Pleurisy root, Asclepias tuberosa, is specifically for reducing inflammation in the pleura and the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
They can be used interchangeably to some extent. The lymph node centers in the lungs are heavily affected during influenza, much more so than in the periphery. And so he goes on and on. You've got to get, if you have an interest and you have the patience to read through this information and image in your mind as you are that virus passing through these different layers, these different layers, you will come to understand influenza. And you come to, as you read, he gives you what to use at each step of the way. So it makes sense, as we have done, to put elements of those, the treatment for those stages in a remedy, in a, what we call a sacrament for influenza, so that you can take it through the course of the infection, and what is needed in the individual stages is given, is what is useful for the most part during that time. So you can give, for example, elderberry for viral, or viral infection, especially influenza, mm-hmm. at a certain time, but it's absolutely useless during five or six other stages, right?
Yep.
So to give elderberry alone is ridiculous, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
I take vitamin C and colloidal silver. Well, okay. For stage one and two, fine. But what if you miss stage one and two? And they get into the cells.
Here's the thing. By the time you have symptoms, you're well into stage three.
Yeah, so hello. You know, you're days into it. Days into it. So he talks about other things. You know, it goes on and it goes. He goes on and on for pages in this. And actually really points out the stages of influenza and what to use in those stages. That isn't something that natural healers are taught.
No.
I mean, what in the world good is a book that says, you know, pleurisy root is good for flu?
I haven't read.
No, it doesn't say that. It says pleurisy root is good for the lungs.
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't, from pleurisy root, I haven't read it anywhere else, but it's good for the lungs.
I know, you get into these training programs
Look,
for a so-called herbalist.
And lung support.
Yeah, lung health and lung support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happened was, you got in trouble. The law was such that you couldn't say what an herb did.
Right.
And this was
yeah.
this was a protectionism. This was nothing more than market protection
mm-hmm.
in the medical industry. Then came a law that said that you could say something about herbs so long as you were only talking about structure and function.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble was, by the time we got through the Inquisition.
The grass period.
By the time you got through the Inquisition, all of our schools had forgotten
mm-hmm.
how to talk about structure and function in a way that didn't get everybody in trouble. So as they began to teach in structure and function, everybody started diagnosing and treating with drugs from herbs again.
Right, yeah.
So manufacturing companies now, when you read their information, their marketing information about this herb or that herb, it's like you just said, for lung support. What does that mean? You know, what supports the lungs? I mean, come on, let's use the English language here. What supports the lungs in your body?
The pulmonary myofascia.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sling of tissue, for crying out loud, is supporting.
The anterior paraspinal ligamentures.
I mean, we're not talking about emotional support for the lungs, okay? This is not group. You're not in therapy. Let's say what is for real. And the great thing about being a minister of natural healing is that I can talk about what is real again. There is a liberation in that.
Yeah.
It's a real liberating feeling to not have to be looking over my shoulder and checking my thesaurus every 5 seconds. Oh, can I say that? Can I actually say tonic? You know, because...
I don't know.
When I got my degree, I couldn't.
Right.
I could not, because that to tone is something that is legislated
mm-hmm.
to doctors. You couldn't say tonic. You have to say strengthen or support.
Which is what tone means.
Yeah, strengthen, support. But who talks that language? And when people do begin to learn that language, what are they actually learning? Do they learn what is actually going on?
Not usually.
No, they don't. I mean, are we talking about needing to have an agglutinin inhibitor?
No,
because, you know, you say something like that and people will look at you with that deer in the headlights. Look,
no.
You know, you can see them go dazed.
You end up with people taking a formula for heartburn, for the burn in the throat. They take
right.
a formula, a product, a tea, to help with the burn in the throat, to coat the throat. And also coat the stomach with specific ingredients in there that actually promote the production of stomach acid. Stimulate
right.
the production of stomach acid, yet they're taking it to help with their antacid.
Good.
To help with their acid reflux. Like, what?
That's a great example.
I mentioned that one of our students brought that up today. We were in class today, and one of our students pulled up a list of ingredients that we were going over. This is a tea that someone in her acquaintance was taking regularly for acid reflux. And we looked at each of the ingredients, and number one, the major throat coat function was licorice root, which is decent.
Okay, yeah.
That one's good. But it had a couple of other throat coat ingredients that are completely ineffective in a tea form. They need to be taken. We're talking about like slippery elm.
Oh, yeah.
It needs to be a plenty nice and thick.
In a gruel.
In a gruel so yep. that it is actually mechanically coating stuff.
Right.
Not slippery elm extract. Totally different. But then the other ingredients were a pair of astringent herbs, highly astringent herbs.
Oh, my gosh.
And then a stomachic cinnamon bark.
That produces
stomach acid.
Okay, you've
excites
got...
Excites the production of stomach acid.
Yeah, oh my heck.
So
yeah, that's awful. That's
and
terrible.
And this is for heartburn and sore throat.
Sore throat from the...
Sore throat from the
from
heart.
From the acid that's coming up into your esophagus.
Right.
Oh.
But the ingredients produce heartburn for someone who's fighting heartburn.
Yeah, this typifies... the kind of incompetence that is out there in natural medicine.
Especially in the manufacturing.
Yeah.
The manufacturing districts.
The manufacturers, for the most part, say there's science
mm-hmm.
behind what they're producing, but there isn't. There's pop science so often, and there's allopathic.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take a lot of these herbs, for example, well, the great example is Standard Process.
Yeah.
Here's Standard Process takes an herb that may have 200 different synergistic chemicals in it, and the research shows that this herb is effective in treating la-la-la.
They pick maybe one or two constituents.
They pick one.
Yeah.
You can't pick two. There has to be one
mm-hmm.
in order to standardize the amount that's in it. And so instead of giving you the 200 that work together to solve the problem, without even trying to understand what that synergistic process is, they standardize one thing in an extract and dump that in your throat. There is no good sense in that.
We call that an isolate.
Yeah, the isolates
yeah.
are allopathic. And all of you naturopaths and all of you holistic practitioners, whatever the hell that means, actually, all of you herbalists who are buying Standard Process or that type of
mm-hmm.
product.
Because there are a number of companies that sell standardized products.
Oh, yeah. Every single one of you who are buying into the standardization
mm-hmm.
of herbs need to go back in your garden. You need to, like I said earlier, it may be real comfy, it may be really warm, it may be moist, it may be like the womb, but you need to pull your head out and pull it out fast before you suffocate. I tell you that in all earnestness. You are not holistic. You are allopathic. You're taking allopathic medicine and you're getting your little paintbrush in your hand.
You're just manufacturer salesman.
No, you are.
Commercial salesman.
You're taking allopathic medicine and your paintbrush, and you're painting it green.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you're doing. There is no natural medicine in that. There's no mechanism of action. There's no healing there. That's all you're doing is painting the roses red. Just like the queen.
Painting the roses red.
Yeah, that's like,
painting the roses red.
Why? We have no idea, but we're painting them red. And if you don't paint them red, you'll lose your head. And that's exactly what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
That we are a population of people who need to pull our head out and go back to our gardens and see how plants really work.
Get off our smartphones and into our books.
Read a book again? Are you kidding? That is asking way too much. As when I picked up a book and started reading a book on our radio show, I am sure that half the people who were tuned in, all six of them, three of them, left in that instant. I'm going to read a book, click. I'm out of here, man. I'm out of here. Yeah. There you go. Hey, you had a pretty good class today.
Yeah, it was fun.
And there were quite a few good examples given of some of the things that our apprentices are actually learning.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the experiences that they're having are amazing, and it's the reason that we're teaching apothecaries to make medicine again. Help us out here. When we're off the flu subject for a while.
Well, kind of, sort of, because
one of the examples is a really good flu example.
Not too long ago, we were on a road trip. We were out to
Indiana. Yep.
We had some apprentices out there. They needed to be initiated into the program. And
yeah, they had to get their tattoo.
Hood.
Their hood. And to file off the horns from their forehead so they're not too noticeable.
Yeah. No, but while we were there, I received a call from one of our supplicants here in Springfield who came down with a terrible flu. It had gotten into her lungs. It had gotten into her gut. And, I mean, she was...
It was bad.
It was bad. She was about ready to go to the hospital. And she really didn't want to. And she knew we were out of town. So she called and she goes, "Layla Mutkin, is there anything I can do?" And I said yes.
Yeah.
And I got on the phone with one of our Springfield apprentices who had some tinctures in her cupboard that she had that had just reached maturation. And she was able to put a couple of tinctures together, whip up a little bit more of some of the base extracts that we use, take it over the same day. And here I am in Indiana.
Right.
The doctor's not even in the office. And our apothecary apprentice runs over to the sufferer's house with the tinctures in a bottle, already mixed, and just adds it to some medicine that we already had the sufferer on for some other problem.
A compounding
modulation was what we were doing for.
Right. A compounding apothecary has the ability to modify an individual's protocol on the fly. That's what compounding apothecary means. And here's an example of it in practice.
Uh-huh.
It was amazing.
The ingredients were very specific. The dosage was very specific, added to the correct medicines. They were immune modulating. And we modified her dose for a while. The symptoms persisted, of course. And then I hear back from her a few days later. And
because we were only there for a couple of days.
Yeah, yeah. On the way back, I called back and followed up to see how she was doing. And she sounded so much better. She did not have to go. The supplicant did not have to go to the hospital, did not have to go to the emergency room. Her energy was back. All that was left of that horrible flu within 2 days was hoarseness in the chest and a little bit of a cough.
Yeah, because as we just read, there have been cell damage, lots of cell damage.
Yep.
Naturally, that has to rebuild. But here's the thing. The apothecary apprentice, now we're talking about the lowest level of training here. The apothecary apprentice under the direction of the master, the doctor, was able to go and provide something that short-circuited that flu.
Quickly. Very effectively.
You know, that's what it's all about.
And we calculated in class today, we calculated how many capsules the supplicant would have had to take, that Judy would have had to take, if she were to take those same medicines in dry powder or even standard process form.
Individual
in
things.
In capsules or tablets or whatever. It turned out to be 10 capsules or tablets, one or the other, 3 times a day.
30. Who with the flu is that rhymes. Who with the flu is going to swallow 30 capsules
a day?
Of anything. Of anything. That's ridiculous. That's crazy. Well, that was pretty good a pretty good object lesson.
Oh, it was excellent because literally what she ended up having to do was a tablespoon of the modified sacrament 3 times a day.
A tablespoon of liquid 3 times a day. Who
and
cannot
lots of water,
do that?
And
who,
lots of water, and she was good.
I'm telling you, who could not do that? Who could not do that? Let me give you another example.
Somebody who doesn't know what they're doing.
Well, that's right.
Do that.
That's right. Somebody who doesn't know what they're doing is going to swallow, throat, coat, and produce more acid than they're trying to treat. Years and years and years ago, your sister had an experience. Remember we had that cat?
Yes.
It's kind of...
Taz.
Taz. This may be. This may sound a little bit off the subject, but it has great merit here because she acted as the healer in that case, and way back then, mm-hmm. It got me to thinking, this naturopath, this great doctor, you know, got me thinking about how we need to approach this sort of thing. Taz had a litter of kittens up on Rachel's pillow.
Yeah.
Gross. We got it all cleaned up and everything. And I'd been traveling quite a bit through the state in Utah at the time, and I wasn't home that often. I mean, we're mm-hmm. trying to get our lives back together.
We were doing a lot of roadshow seminars.
Right, yeah. Right. And so I get back, and the cat has gone down. The cat has collapsed. Mm-hmm. The cat can't lift its head. You know, and she asked me to go look at the cat, and the memories were huge, and they were hot. And she was so sick, and I had yeah. not been around. It was way too late. You know, by the time a cat cannot lift its head, you're in deep, deep doo-doo.
Typically a matter of time.
Minutes.
The cats give up really easily at that point.
At that point, they don't even yeah. try. They could come back, but usually they just don't try. Mm-hmm. They just go to sleep and go to, and they die. So I told her, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I wasn't there. But you're going to have to prepare yourself. This is her favorite cat. You're going to have to prepare yourself. She's probably going to go tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And she got mad at me. You remember that?
I do.
She got mad at me.
She looked like Grandma Landis.
She put this. She had this
Grandma Landis face on her.
She didn't say anything snotty or anything like that. She got mad at me. She went to the kitchen. She got some water.
Mm-hmm.
She got some Tiaga. She got some other things, and she went upstairs, and she sequestered herself in the room. And little by little, drop by mm-hmm. drop, she administered tiny amounts of medicine, an immune modulator, tiny amounts of medicine to that cat. Well, the cat didn't die.
She spent the whole day and most of the next day doing that.
Well, and then I go back up in, because the cat didn't die, mm-hmm. I'm saying, well, okay, this is not your usual thing. What really is going on? And upon closer examination, it was not severe and toxic mastitis. It was cancer. Mm-hmm. The mammaries were full on one mm-hmm. side of cancer. So needless to say, the kittens didn't make it, but I had to say again, I'm so sorry. I totally missed this. I assumed because she just had the kittens
and
because it was big
yeah.
and it was hot, I assumed, I said to her, you're just going to have to be prepared. There is no way out for this. It's really advanced. It's hugely advanced.
Cancer.
I mean, it was huge.
Yeah.
It was as big as my hand. What do you do? So she got more mad at me. She locked herself in the room with that cat, just as an apothecary would do, very carefully compounded, changing mm-hmm. things up, and just kept that cat receiving the medicine. This was an immune modulatory medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember how many days it was, but I get up.
2 weeks.
I get up.
It was 2 weeks.
It kept her going, kept her going. Then I get up. And this cat is sitting on the bottom step of the stairs.
Cleaning herself.
Licking herself. And she's got this huge hole in her abdomen. The cancer, the cat's immune system, because of the
I'll
care.
I'll never forget that.
It was horrifying.
Wow.
It was horrifying because of the care that this healer, this true healer, took in carefully maintaining, carefully changing, carefully compounding for the cat,
mm-hmm.
caused the cat's body and the immune system to sequester the tumor, the masses of tumor, mm-hmm. away from her body, and the whole thing sloughed off.
Yep.
It just came away. Well, okay. Now my daughter is saying, I told you so, I told you so, but here's this cat, wide open to the elements. So I had to clean it all up and sew her back together. Well, actually, I used super glue, remember?
First, but she kept cleaning it off.
Yeah, super glue. But the cat went on to live and have a couple more litters of kittens. And, you know, we moved to another place
she found new owners.
She found new owners. Yeah. Who knows how much longer she lived. Well, there's an example of the kind of thing that we should be teaching our apothecaries. All natural healers need to be teaching this way. If she had used some smart naturopath's counsel, the cat would have died.
Because that's the counsel she got at the time.
Right, right. So if we use...
From you and from the vet, it was basically the same.
Oh, yeah, the vet just said, cat's going to die.
I can put her down, is what he said.
Is what he said. But here's the thing. If we had followed... If we as healers disregard 200 chemicals in a plant because the one is the popular one, mm-hmm. the one that can earn you money... then we're going to be seeing a lot of cats die, aren't we? And we do.
Yeah, we do.
The trouble is, they're people that we know. That's that was a message that my daughter gave to me, the Good Deal Naturopath, the doctorate-level educated experience, you know. We have to be teaching common sense. And the common sense has built into it the ability to observe things as they really are. Yeah. Not the way some company wants it to be. And that was a lesson I learned.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me thinking from that day. It really altered how I think of natural medicine. And that was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, not 20 years ago. It was...
Not quite.
It was 15, 16 years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
I think I was...
I was 16. Yeah, you were 16. So there you go.
We had the trooper.
As a result of that experience mm-hmm. and a couple others like that, we have, because of that, the experience that our apprentice had up here
mm-hmm.
when we were gone to Indiana. Because of the ability to observe and to be at the right place, the right time, mm-hmm. the right stage of influenza because of what we're teaching.
And to use the right medicines at the right time.
And know why.
Yeah.
That's an important thing that healers are not being taught.
Mm-hmm.
Healers are not being taught. I certainly wasn't taught it. I had to go back and get more information. I had to continue studying. The information I got from my herbology, quote, air quote, herbology courses was horrible. It was horrendous. It was lacking in everything.
Our professor of plant medicine, Dr. Joan Schrader, she reports the same thing to me. Occasionally she will lament over the phone. Like, why did I waste that money?
She had a master's degree in herbology.
Yeah.
She got a doctorate in naturopathic medicine. And
she was getting the best of what was available.
Well,
It's not a great statement.
It's not a great statement at all.
But it's a fact.
It's not a great statement at all. Did you have any other examples you wanted to give from your class today?
More subtle examples. One thing that popped up was the difference one of our apprentices felt. When we bring on an apprentice, the first thing we do is assess their level of health and craft a formula specifically for them. We want them to have a concrete experience with regard to their own health recovery. It's really important because they need to have something to talk about, but they also need to be well.
Good point.
And in this case, the comment that she made was, you know, here again, we've got formula that's specifically crafted for specific needs, but not necessarily hit all the symptoms. We're going for causation. That's what we were
right.
doing.
Yeah.
So after a couple of weeks on the regimen that we had her on, she, in class today, reported that she never realized until 2 weeks into her regimen, how fatigued she had been for so long.
Oh, she'd been fatigued for so long, she didn't even know how fatigued she was.
Yep. That was the difference, that the right medicine in the right dosage was for her.
And the medicine was very simple. It wasn't 15 bottles of anything.
And she made it.
She made it herself?
She made it herself.
That is so awesome.
She's an apprentice apothecary. She made her medicine and because of that experience, she's ready to do what our other apprentice was able to do for our supplicant here.
For herself.
Yeah.
So, yeah, every one of our apothecary apprentices becomes their own first case study.
Another one again, we're dealing with flu. Flu season, poor kid, constantly taken to the emergency room, antibiotics up the wazoo, antivirals up the wazoo because the kid's always sick. There's no immune system there is what they want to say.
Nah.
And again,
like,
one of...
Like that's even possible.
One of our apprentices couldn't get a stable phone connection. So we're talking over text message. And she's talking to the supplicant. The supplicant's describing the symptoms. And our apprentice had the necessary tinctures, the necessary herbs to make a proper extract. And a couple of... about a week later, hears back, and the girl is doing well. The little girl's doing well. She hasn't been well for a long time. She struggled with constant illness and flus and just about any infection, any of the seasonal infections you get for a long time. And she said she feels really good.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's really cool.
That's got to be dang gratifying for our apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've told people as I'm interviewing new apprentices around the country, because that's a privilege that I have. It's kind of a really fun thing. I interview them on the telephone or over Skype. One of the things I get to say, and I mean this, you know, very sincerely,
mm-hmm.
there is little else in my life that has brought more pleasure than to be at the moment of aha.
Yeah.
To be at that moment where a little child learns a thing for the first mm-hmm. time that is so cool, or to be at that moment when a person recognizes the recovery.
Yeah.
To be in that recovery moment, it just does something so remarkable to you.
It's exhilarating.
It leaves such an impact on you that you want to keep on doing mm-hmm. it. You want to do this for the rest of your life.
It's not a sense of self-gratification or like that. It's just...
No, not by any means.
It's a...
You're just there at that moment.
It's like a celebration. You feel it deep inside your core.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like I remember the first time I actually got to dig out the wishbone from a turkey. And that there was that moment where you actually saw it and where it is in that carved turkey. And you pulled it out and it was like, oh,
mm-hmm.
it's part of the keel. It's that, you know, and that was for me, I mean, that was a really cool mm-hmm. aha moment. And I've had those moments in anatomy and physiology. I've had those moments in chemistry. I've had mm-hmm. those moments in biology.
I do that with mythology a lot.
Yeah, where you... Oh, I get that. Yeah, the moment where you get it. There is nothing, I think, more... I mean, that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing is fun. But it pales in comparison to being in the moment, there shoulder to shoulder, you know, working closely with a person
mm-hmm.
who has the healing experience.
Just to see that in their eyes after, who knows, and some people, they've been suffering for a long time.
Yeah.
The suffering is normal to them. That's how long.
That's what gets pretty sad. And so the aha moment is really huge mm-hmm. for those folks, and it's very impactful.
Yeah, for me, the sensation, I think, is virtually indescribable. I could try to describe it all night.
Yeah, we could go on and on. And I often do, but it's what I was trying to express to a new apprentice who's coming on tonight. You know, how do you describe that kind of experience?
Right.
You know,
it's an aha. It's like, this is right. It's like all things for that in that moment, all things are right.
Right. So I think that we as educators, we must, going forward, and I'm not just talking about our school, I'm mm-hmm. talking about all the schools in my profession, we must going forward, provide a dog pile of such experiences
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, occupy a student's time for 3, 4, maybe 5 years, charge them a lot of money, give them a pretty looking piece of paper, and then dump them out on a sidewalk somewhere and say, okay, you're Dr. Bob, go be good.
Go sell pills.
We can't do that.
Yeah,
you sell these pills. You sell the rot and rot. We can't do that anymore. We have to provide a dog pile of hands-on experience in the healing of ills, in the relieving of suffering, in the manufacture and the development of protocols, of sacraments. And, you know, we have to do this. Yeah. If we're not going to do this, if you schools out there are not going to do this, I challenge you to close your doors. I really do. Because what you're producing is incompetence for all of your, you know, lofty words and your high-priced curriculums. You are producing a whole raft of rank incompetence. All of you schools that are doing these weekend seminars that, you know, and you're writing these certificates for the certified natural healthcare coach or practitioner or what have you, shame on you. Shame on you, because you're giving people the impression that they have competence, and they do not.
And point of fact, in a crisis, in a moment of crisis, whether it's ecological or economic, if it's regional, if it's just in someone's little hometown,
Or
in their home, that's right. Incompetence kills.
Incompetence kills, that's right. And we have to stop as a profession. And this is my message for tonight. We're gonna end this 10 minutes early, that's okay. But this is my message for tonight. Stop. Whether you're a school, whether you're an individual, get real competence. Real competence is delivered through residency training. And so if you are a school that produces pieces of paper that say doctor on them and there has not been any hands-on residency training, rethink. Rethink. Now, that's what the word repent means, rethink.
Yeah.
So I'm calling you as a minister of healing. I am calling you to repentance. Well, thank you. I had to go there, didn't I? Well, thank you once again for listening to us. We're going to archive these radio programs, and they will all be available on the website. I just heard from Chief Wellamutkin that he's going to take the time to do that. And we have ranted about a lot of things, and we'll continue to do this. And some people might someday think this is pretty cool stuff. Right now, I don't think that we really get that many listeners, but
I'm going to click the button now.
I do want to thank everybody who does come in and listen to the program. We do appreciate you, and we appreciate you giving us the opportunity to sit here and rant.
And we really love feedback.
We do, and we're not getting much. We would love to have your feedback. So this is Chief Cloud Piler with Chief Wellamutkin, and I'm going to sign off by saying walk sacred and be well. See you next time.